Kenneth Nackbar here on behalf of Appellant Central Mortgage Company, and I'd like to introduce Nicholas Boyle of Williams & Connolly, LLP. He's been admitted pro hoc vice, and with the court's permission, he'll be arguing on behalf of Central Mortgage this afternoon.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Stephen Feynman of Richards, Leighton & Finger, on behalf of Appellee Morgan Stanley Mortgage Capital Holdings, LLC, I'd like to make some brief introductions. Sitting at council table with me today, Jeffrey Smith from Bingham McCutcheon.
Welcome.
Cynthia Hanawalt from Bingham McCutcheon.
Welcome.
And Stephen Herman of my office from Richards, Leighton & Finger. With the court's permission, Mr. Smith will be addressing the court this afternoon. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. You ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Please.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 of my 25 minutes for rebuttal. The core issues on appeal today are straightforward. In a contract breach case brought by Central Mortgage against Morgan Stanley, the Chancery Court found notice to be a condition precedent and, moreover, did not credit the allegations that Morgan Stanley received notice and, indeed, cured on previous occasions. We would submit that the Chancery Court failed to apply the motion to dismiss standard and further failed to apply New York law. First, the court found a condition precedent under New York law when every court considering the issue under New York law has found the same clause to be a mere promise. Second, the court did not apply Chancery Rule 9C, which holds that even if the clause were a condition precedent, it would be sufficient to aver generally that it had been fulfilled. Third, the motion to dismiss standards were reversed. For example, the reasonable inference from a cure is that there has been notice. But Morgan's cure payments were explained away by the Chancery Court on the basis of Morgan's rival factual interpretation. The complaint also pleads that Morgan received demand letters concerning detailed information about specific loans and specific flaws in specific loans, including misrepresentations, and they were passed on to Morgan Stanley. If those allegations had been credited, even if notice had been mandatory, the case should not have been dismissed. In short, Morgan Stanley is a sophisticated party. If it had wished to contract for a notice provision that was a condition precedent, it could have done so, could have added particular language. If Morgan Stanley had wanted to contract for a notice provision that specified exactly the type of formal notice that had to be provided, it could have added that language. Morgan Stanley invited the court here to rewrite the notice provision to address those two issues and, moreover, not to credit the allegations of notice in the complaint. And in sum, that is why we think dismissal should be reversed.
Can I interrupt you for a second? If I understand correctly, the trial court said it's dismissed without prejudice and all you have to do is provide the notice that the trial court found you had not done and, what is it, 60-day cure period, and then you're ready to go. It's been, I'm sure, a lot more than 60 days and you're going to have to wait for a decision from this court. Why not just, even if the trial court was wrong, do it over again and then start up your litigation?
Justice Berger, I think the issue is that I could talk about beyond the scope of this appeal what we are also doing in parallel to the appeal, but we think there's an issue of principle here in that we think the provision was wrongly interpreted as a condition precedent, and as we found out, that provision is in many mortgage-related contracts. But simply the burden on Central Mortgage every time to inject the lawyers into the process and put together a kind of pseudo-complaint with restating the facts, attaching it to particular representations, adds a significant burden. I think the crux of the allegations show that the notice system was working. The one that was in place was working where the lawyers didn't need to be involved and Central Mortgage could pass on the demand letters from the agencies to Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley could attempt to cure, and if it couldn't cure, would make the payment. That system was in place.
Mr. Boyle, so I gather your league position is that, you know, for purposes of a motion to dismiss, number one, that there was compliance with the notice provision, and that the 47 cases, individual cases, where notice was given simply by delivering the Fannie Mae documents to Morgan Stanley, you know, was essentially an acknowledgement by Morgan Stanley that they had gotten sufficient notice, if only because they cured whatever the problem was that led to the return of the loan. Your second position is even if the notice wasn't technically sufficient, it wasn't a condition precedent, or at the very least, there's enough uncertainty under New York law as to whether it was a condition precedent that it was improper to dismiss the case on the pleadings.
Yes, Justice Jacobs, that is correct, with one small tweak, which is we think that the cases are, in fact, completely clear that under New York law, indeed, one of the cases, the provision was almost verbatim, but all four cases that we cited said that this was a mere promise. And they did so based on the text of the provision. The text of the provision is silent as to the form of notice and is clear that it can be satisfied in two ways. And so the four cases that we cited, the two LaSalle cases, the Lehman Brothers case, and the Love Funding case, said this provision does not have conditional language. You could add it, but it doesn't have it provided. It doesn't have simply notice. It could be triggered by either party. And on its face, it looks like it provides for a set-off rather than a condition precedent. Now, there is law saying that in cases of ambiguity, New York courts generally lean towards a promise, but the Southern District in the trust certificates Love Funding case said, we don't need the benefit of that presumption. We can read this. This is clear, and there was no condition precedent. Now, tellingly, none of the courts analyzing the case considered whether there was actual notice on the facts. They simply looked at the provision and interpreted it. However, in all of those cases, there wasn't actual notice, at least not of the type that Morgan Stanley has insisted has to be provided. In the trust certificates case, the court held that it was undisputed that Payne Weber had never provided Love Funding written notice. In the Lehman case, interestingly, the plaintiff received a letter saying, you're in breach of the mortgage purchase agreement. What the plaintiff did was simply forward that to the defendant and say, let's have a discussion about this. That was the first notice, which is fairly analogous to the situation that we have here. In the LaSalle case, there was simply notification of a fact, which was a default, and a request for payment. Now, Morgan has taken the position in its papers that those cases don't apply here because there's a factual distinction, because in those cases there was actual notice. But if that is really the standard, that it's passing something on, or in the Love Funding case they talked about general awareness that there was something going on, then certainly our pleadings pass that test.
To what extent did the Vice Chancellor address those the New York case law?
The Vice Chancellor did not address those cases. The Vice Chancellor relied on six cases, three of which were cited by Morgan Stanley, and three of which were as a result of the Vice Chancellor's own legal research. If I could turn now to the allegations in the complaint.
So you did allege that Morgan Stanley was aware of the breaches?
Yes.
Did you have a reference, a paragraph?
We allege that in each case, that's complaint paragraph 69, we received notice from Morgan. We received notice from the agencies. We passed it on to Morgan Stanley. In paragraph 68, we said, recognizing...
What about of a breach?
Justice Ridgely. Paragraph 68, we said, recognizing breaches of the flow agreement, Morgan Stanley made the payments to us. So we said that Morgan Stanley, we pled that it was aware of the breaches, and we did so because it had received these notices. As we pled in the complaint, we basically had back-to-back representations from Morgan and from Morgan and us to the agencies, and therefore Morgan was on notice of particular misrepresentations when it received the notice. Now, I mentioned opening that our burden under Chancery Rule 9C was simply to generally aver that the condition precedent, even if it existed, was fulfilled, and we did that in the complaint at paragraphs 96 and 104. But we did go beyond that and put in the specific allegations of notice that we received the demand letters from the agencies, that each time, the 47 times, but also the 50 times when we haven't been paid, that we passed those on to Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley acknowledged their receipt and said it would review the alleged breaches. That's in complaint paragraph 70. And then there was an elaborate process where Morgan Stanley dealt with the agencies, dealt with us, attempted to cure, in some cases cured, and then 47 times where it couldn't, it made the payment to us. And we've pled that the form of notice, both for the 47 and now the 50 unpaid, was exactly the same. That's in paragraph 69. And in 79, we pled that 60 days notice was indeed given. Our submission is that dismissal could only be granted if there were no set of facts inferable from the pleadings that would support notice or discovery, and we think that's simply insurmountable. Morgan, in a sort of eye-catching phrase, said in its brief, notice means notice of something. But as I've pled, they certainly got something. They got particularized notices, one for each loan, specifying particularized flaws in each loan, and clearly they were good enough because they made payments.
All of the 47 or 50 cases involved, at least from the standpoint of the agencies, the misrepresentation?
Yes.
And your position is misrepresentation is a ground that is, you know, can be the basis for a breach as far as your side's relationship with Morgan Stanley was concerned?
Yes.
Morgan Stanley appears to argue that that a misrepresentation may create a breach, but only if it's material. And what is your position on that issue?
Well, I think factually there was a process by which Morgan Stanley could, once it was on notice, could make its case and argue that it was immaterial or somebody had made a mistake or otherwise somehow nullify the accusation, and perhaps it was on materiality grounds, but when it couldn't, it had to make the payment. And as for our allegations of materiality, we've looked at that issue in a number of ways. We've made a pleading based on, for example, that the particular misrepresentations are the subject of Morgan Stanley lawsuits against originators where they have pled that they're material. We've taken the position that...
Well, I wasn't asking for your position on the merits of materiality, but your position insofar as it relates to the pleading issue, that is the issue of whether notice was adequately pled.
If I understand your question, we did plead that each of these breaches which were the subject of the notices were material. That pleading is in there. And so, therefore, we think that's sufficient at this stage.
Well, one way to read the Court of Chancery opinion is that everything happened with regard to the problems that were addressed was Morgan Stanley trying to work things out, and to the extent it didn't insist on formal notice, it's simply because it was an effort at accommodation. But once it paid whatever it paid, it said, that's it. From now on, we're going to do it by the letter. And the Court of Chancery seemed to accept that account, didn't it?
Yes. And we would say that that alone is grounds for reversal, in that it took perhaps a factual dispute, or it's not even a factual dispute because it credited an assertion in opposing counsel's briefs. We're at the motion to dismiss stage, and yet That was included in the Chancery Court's opinion.
Your position is that from the complaint, one can reasonably infer a counter-explanation, and that is that Morgan Stanley was simply accepting your side's handling of these matters as adequate notice.
Absolutely.
And since there were two equally plausible explanations, then dismissal could not be granted on that basis.
Absolutely. And moreover, in addition to reversing that standard, we think the Chancery Court reversed the motion to dismiss standard in its interpretation of the notice clause. As I referred to earlier, the notice clause simply talks about providing notice. The Chancery Court gave it an expansive interpretation. I think at best you could say that the parties may have a dispute, but the Chancery Court there picked an interpretation, and under this court's precedent, VLIW, unless it's the only plausible reading, the Chancery Court is simply not permitted to do that, and particularly where here the provision on its face that says that discovery is sufficient. I'd like to talk for a moment about sort of the policy underpinning notice. The reason notice is in a contract, we would submit, is to let the alleged breacher attempt to cure. And what we have pled in the complaint is that's exactly what happened here. We had this process in place where they had the opportunity to cure, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. Now, tellingly, Morgan Stanley simply stopped cooperating, wrote letters saying we're closing the file. At no point is there anything in that letter which we've quoted saying we're not paying because we're not on notice. It's simply, for reasons that I think will come out in discovery, decided to stop paying, but did not ever say in those letters that it somehow lacked notice. If I may, I will switch just for a moment to the other issue on appeal, which is the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Our position there is that, again, there's no set of facts that would support such a claim. I'd like to make two points. One is we pled in the complaint that there were actions and statements outside the contract in terms of false statements to us about the use of a standard contract with the agencies or statements about the diligencing of these loans. And Morgan Stanley took the position below and also on appeal that those are outside the contract. There's an integration clause. Those are mere oral statements. But that position undermines the basis for dismissal of the claim. The basis of dismissal was it's duplicative. The same allegations were made under express breach and implied covenant. But Morgan Stanley's own position is that cannot be the case because there's an integration clause.
Well, the implied covenant claim is an alternative claim that presupposes that there is no contract claim.
That is correct.
So is your position that if there is no contract, then we're not barred by parole evidence or by any other rule from relying on the inducement to enter into this relationship?
That is our position, and one instructive case is the Chase Manhattan case, the Southern District case that we cited, where the court said you have a 70-page contract, these are sophisticated parties, it's got a merger clause, and you have an express breach claim. But you've also alleged that there were oral misrepresentations and conduct outside the contract. In that case, it was diverting mutual fund payments. And the court in that instance said that can form the basis for the implied covenant claim, particularly at the motion to dismiss stage, and that can go forward. Now, there's another line of implied covenant cases. The Dalton case, Court of Appeals case in New York, describes the implied covenant as including promises that a reasonable person would expect to have been included. Now, we've pled, therefore, that even if there's no technical breach of the contract itself, a reasonable expectation is that we would be reimbursed for the agency putbacks. it could be said that any litigant could come before the court and say, oh, my reasonable expectation was I was going to be paid $100 million, even though it's not in the contract. We don't have that problem here because our reasonable expectation, A, was fulfilled 47 different times, and B, we have pled that the payment by the loan seller to the agencies and the reimbursement of the servicer is the industry standard, which we pled at paragraph 64. So for two reasons, we have a reasonable expectation of payment, even if there was no contractual breach. If I may conclude, and as I say, I'm going to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, we did have a system in place for notice that clearly worked. Morgan Stanley acknowledged both in writing and by its conduct that it was working. The first time we heard of the notice issue was in Morgan Stanley's legal briefs. And we would submit that this ex post facto argument for a super heightened standard, notice standard, simply adds costs to CMC. It adds costs to many other parties who have the same provision in their agreements, and we've seen from the New York cases that includes many, many parties. And yet there's absolutely no benefit because Morgan Stanley knew what the allegations were. We'd also submit that absent reversal of the Chancery Court, there's an inconsistency being created in the interpretation of this clause. You have all the New York courts interpreting it one way and an outlying case in Delaware. And thus, at the pleading stage here, when we have notice pled, when we have cures pled, where we have a clause with a discovery standard, we believe the complaint is not subject to dismissal on those counts. Thank you.
May it please the Court. I'd like to begin with the obvious for a little context. The parties in this case are two substantial, very sophisticated financial institutions. They know their business and they know their markets. In 2005, well before any rumblings of the credit crisis, at a time when there weren't lots of defaults, at a time when anybody could refinance their mortgage, you know, in a heartbeat, years before Freddie Mac thought about returning mortgages to anybody, these two parties got together to talk about doing a negotiated transaction that was going to have some legs and length to it. So they negotiated an agreement. I'm sure their lawyers told them to write it down, and they did. 66 pages, 15 exhibits attached to those 66 pages. Very comprehensive agreement. It purported to govern, in all respects, Morgan Stanley's sale of servicing rights to CMC over a period of years. We call it the master agreement. And the master agreement was then going to be supplemented by individual transaction agreements because essentially they were going to buy, you know, roughly $1 billion of servicing every couple of months. And they did. There were, in fact, 25 separate transactions under this master agreement. For a while, the agreement worked just fine. There was kind of a glitch in 2007, as their complaint alleges, and the parties negotiated again. They amended the contract in writing, as required, gave CMC certain additional protections. But then the credit crisis begins, and all of a sudden, things change. And most especially, CMC's willingness to accept the risks it agreed to in this contract disappears. The agency started, as they allege in their complaint, in January 2008, the agency start putting mortgages back to CMC as servicer. In the master agreement, Section 301, CMC committed to purchase those mortgages back, committed to Morgan Stanley. Now, it also committed to the agencies in a separate transaction to take those mortgages back, and it did. It honored those requirements, but not happily. And so all of a sudden, CMC looks at this master agreement and says, you know, we're not really happy with the way this works. You know, because it doesn't impose on Morgan Stanley the obligation that we'd like it to have, which is to buy these things back itself. And it doesn't give us a remedy against Morgan Stanley, the remedy we'd like to have, which is to force Morgan Stanley to buy these things back. Those are not in this agreement, as the Chancery Court correctly found. So they file a 50-page, 10-count complaint in Chancery Court. It's clearly designed with one purpose and only one purpose in mind. They're trying to effectuate a massive revision and restructuring of the party's obligations under the master agreement through a legal proceeding. Not in a bankruptcy court, mind you, but in the Chancery Court. And as the Chancery Court was quick to point out, that's not what I do. That's not what a court of law does. Courts of law apply agreements as written. We don't revise the agreements because one party finds, years after the contract was entered into, that it's not such a good bargain anymore. As the Chancery Court said when it dismissed the contract claims without prejudice, rather generously in our view, it said if CMC refiles its claims, and it hasn't, CMC must acknowledge the reality that it entered into a complex written agreement with terms that did not guarantee a risk-free deal. Now, I'd submit, Your Honors, that this appeal is kind of a variation on a theme. CMC goes in Chancery Court and basically says, please rewrite the master agreement for me. And now it's here in this court saying, please rewrite my complaint for me. But that's not what an appellate court does. CMC pled itself out of court in Chancery. Vice Chancellor Strein understood it. They have an opportunity to replead if they want to. But the fact is, this was not a failure by the Chancery Court to apply proper pleading standards. To the contrary, the Chancery Court applied three very basic, well-settled pleading rules in dismissing all of these claims. What were those rules? Number one, courts do not credit allegations in a pleading concerning what a contract supposedly says, where, as here, those allegations are inconsistent with the text of the written agreement which is appended to the complaint. There are many cases from this court so holding. How could the law be anything else? The agreement says what it says. That's what courts enforce.
Well, do you agree with the assessment the other side has made that it was pled that Morgan Stanley recognized its breaches?
Absolutely not.
Well, isn't the word recognizing its breaches, or isn't that phrase in the complaint?
They make two points, Your Honor. First, they claim that they gave notice, this is their paragraph 79, important paragraph, they said, they gave notice to Morgan Stanley that the agencies were putting loans back to them because the agencies claimed there were breaches. That's nice. And if the master agreement said, if you were obligated, you represent and warrant that the agencies will not put these loans back to us, that would be all they'd have to do. But there is no such obligation. There is no such representation and warranty, and that's the point the Vice Chancellor was making. There are separate representations and warranties in this master agreement. They are 100% not the same as what was represented to the agencies. And again, look at the written contract as the Vice Chancellor did, and you see that immediately. There is essentially strict liability type concepts for the agencies if you sell them a loan. And if anything doesn't work, they attempt to put it back to you. There's no back-to-back representation like that in this agreement. Not a chance. In fact, in this pleading, CMC alleges that most of the loans were being put back by the agencies because of borrower fraud. And you understand, of course, that Morgan Stanley didn't originate these loans. Other people originated these loans. Morgan Stanley bought the loans. So they had no direct relationship with the borrower. And in the master agreement, the representation says only Morgan Stanley has no knowledge of any borrower representation. That's a totally different representation than what was found
elsewhere.
Can
I interrupt you for a minute? Sure. Because I feel like I must be in another world right now. I thought that the trial court said that these claims are being dismissed because you haven't adequately alleged notice of the breaches that you claim took place, and that CMC is free to replead and properly allege notice. I didn't understand the trial court to have been making determinations on the merits of the claims or the contract.
Well,
am I wrong there?
I think you are, Your Honor, in the sense that there were many other dismissals with prejudice, including, for example,
but that's not
an anticipatory repudiation.
Okay, but that's not what's before us, is it?
No, but the court's findings as to what the contract meant or didn't mean, which were included in another section of his opinion, surely is before the court.
But all right, again, I'm troubled by this because I thought the only thing we're looking at other than the implied covenant claim is whether the trial court properly determined that the allegations of notice were insufficient and therefore the claims had to be dismissed.
No, I do not believe that's the only thing this court should be looking at. There were multiple grounds put before Chancery Court which it did not need to reach but which were fully preserved and have been presented to this court in our brief that independently would justify the ruling. It is true they have focused their attack, if you will, on the decision on the notice issue, but there are independent grounds with respect to each and every one of these claims that were properly raised, presented to the court, and fully preserved. The fact the court didn't need to reach them doesn't mean that they're not
well,
preserved.
Well, then shouldn't you have cross-appealed? Because it sounds as if you're saying that we don't have to really focus on notice because these claims didn't even state a claim, and that's what the trial court found, and in that case it would be dismissed with prejudice.
We did not cross-appeal because we are not seeking to reverse the decision of the court with respect to dismissals without prejudice. And so long as we are not seeking to change the ultimate disposition, and we are not, we believe that those arguments are all fairly presented and capable of being considered by this court under Delaware precedent.
Well, the only claims that are before us are the contract claim, breach of contract claim, and the implied covenant claim. The rationale of the Court of Chancery for dismissing those claims is set forth in compartmentalized sections of the opinion, each addressing those two claims. Are you suggesting that the opinion is not defensible standing on its own with respect to those two claims, and we have to read those portions of the opinion together with other portions unrelated to those claims in order to sustain it?
I believe that the opinion is sustainable based on precisely the reasons that the Vice Chancellor gave. However, to the second point, Mr. Justice, I think you should be reading the entire opinion because there are findings and conclusions made in other portions of the opinion that absolutely do bear on whether or not count one for breach of contract is a viable claim.
Even though the Vice Chancellor didn't consider them relevant or that they bore on his analysis.
I think the Vice Chancellor had to deal with 10 claims and he wrote his opinion the way he wrote it. I don't think that his expectation was that he had to set forth each and every ground for each and every claim, but I don't want to speak for him either. What I do know is he made it very clear in the course of the other sections of his opinion that, for example, their breach of contract claim, let's talk for a minute about what is their breach of contract claim, because I didn't hear anything about it
actually,
in that presentation.
Before you get to that, if I understand the opinion correctly, the Vice Chancellor held, among other things, that but for the notice problem, that is the inadequate pleading of notice, that the substance of the complaint either stated a grounds for rescission of some of these contracts or may have stated a ground for rescission.
He did suggest at one point that there could be a basis for a claim. Of course, he also suggested that their existing claims were some measure from plausible. So I don't know exactly how to square those two comments, and I didn't try. But nonetheless, I would suggest that if you – let's just take a moment, if Your Honor pleases, to look at this contract claim. What is it? I haven't heard even what the claim is. Here's the claim, pled. It says, Morgan Stanley agreed to sell only what CMC calls agency loans, by which it apparently means loans meeting agency guidelines and permanently retained by the agencies. But the master agreement doesn't use the term agency loan. It uses the term mortgage loan. And it doesn't obviously, therefore, ascribe to a non-existent term the meaning that this plaintiff is suggesting it has. The Chancery Court found, here's a finding, nowhere does the master agreement state that the loans would satisfy agency guidelines. That finding totally defeats on a 12B6 basis the first count in this complaint. Now, he happened to make it in the context of discussing why the anticipatory repudiation of contract claim fails, but it's a finding, and it's fully applicable here.
Could you focus on the adequacy of the allegations of notice?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
That seems to be what the trial court found dispositive.
Absolutely. And what the trial court said was that both with respect to the extent that the first claim is focused on individual loans, to the extent it is, and certainly the second claim focused on breaches of representations and warranties, those claims, the court said, are subject to the notice provision in section 10.13. And the court said that, and the court essentially found as follows. In paragraph 104 of the complaint, CMC makes the allegation that it's performed all of its obligations and satisfied all conditions preceding in the master agreement. That's what it alleges. But the problem with that allegation is, and as we pointed out in our moving papers to the Chancery Court, and that CMC made no serious effort to rebut, by the way, in front of the Chancery Court at all. You know, that allegation is inconsistent with the more specific allegations found in paragraph 79. At oral argument, CMC conceded that prior to the filing of this complaint, CMC never notified Morgan Stanley of any specific representation or warranty in the master agreement that Morgan Stanley supposedly breached. Why did they make that concession? Because they never did notify Morgan Stanley of any breach of a rep and warranty in the master agreement. They referred to what the agencies did. True enough.
But the issue, or as I understand, one of the issues is whether they were required to do that, or whether the prior conduct of the parties, particularly the conduct of your client, indicated that your client didn't care whether it received that particular notice. And even if it was required, the related issue of whether that was a condition precedent or merely a promise that would be the subject of an offset or a counterclaim.
Okay, let's go to that. First of all, with respect to the 47 prior loans, I heard today that Morgan Stanley cured those loans. Well, we didn't cure them because the cure called for in the loan agreement, the master agreement, isn't to buy them back. We bought them back, all right? You can't say that that action is a cure, is evidence of a cure under this agreement, because this agreement doesn't require us to buy the loans back.
Well, whether it was a cure or not, it resolved as a practical matter whatever dispute there was among the agency, your client, and CMC, isn't it?
Sure it did, and that's why
those loans. If it's not a cure, at least it goes a long way.
It resolved the issue, doesn't tell you why it was resolved. We're not allowed to get into why Morgan Stanley acted the way it did, but what I will suggest is what we did with some other loans that aren't the subject of this litigation has nothing to do with what we're supposed to do with these loans. There's a clause in this agreement that says, because this is essentially a waiver argument, that's what they're arguing, but there's a clause in the agreement that says if you waive one breach, it's not deemed to be a waiver of any subsequent breach. It's right there. It's part of the deal they made. I mean, that's the problem here is this is a retrade on a contract that they made. Now, let's talk about the notice provision because I know that has been their main focus. But I do want to make it clear that there's no point that they allege that they gave notice of a breach of the reps and warranties in this contract. never happened. I've tried to explain to you why that's an important thing, because knowing that there might be a breach with respect to an agency is not the same thing as knowing that there might be a breach with respect to this particular contract. So, what is the law in New York on conditions precedent? Contrary to CMC's position, in New York, remedy provisions in a contract require prompt notice, such as 1013, are strictly enforced, and they are treated as conditions precedent. The leading cases in New York, which come from, of course, New York's highest court, the Court of Appeals, are Argo Capital, which the Chancery Court cited, and the case that it relies on, Oppenheimer & Company versus Oppenheimer, Pell & Dixon. I like to talk about Oppenheimer because if you want to understand the most kind of expansive explanation of New York law in this area, I think that's the right case to go to, and we cite it in our brief. In that case, the Court of Appeals begins by saying a condition precedent is an act or event other than a lapse of time which, unless the condition is excused, must occur before a duty to perform a promise in the agreement arises. That's the definition, pretty standard stuff. It's right out of the restatement, as best I can tell. Now, the court goes on to emphasize that express conditions must be literally performed. Why? Because they're part of a bargain for section of a contract. You can't not enforce a contract, you know, when that's part of the deal. And then the court goes on to say that interpretation can't be used as a means of turning this into a promise if the occurrence of the event as a condition is expressed in unmistakable language. I submit, take a look at Section 1013 in this agreement. It is very clear. It says, upon discovery by seller or servicer, there has to be notice of the breach of rep and warranty.
Well, let me see if I understand your argument. You appear to be saying that if we look at the master agreement, there were representations and warranties, and there was never any notice given of a breach of those representations and warranties.
Correct.
But we do know that at least 47 loans were resolved. And to the extent they said to Morgan Stanley, we've got a problem, and Morgan Stanley was willing to deal with the problem, Morgan Stanley seems to take the view whatever the problem was not a breach of the representations in the master agreement. It was just good public relations.
Or whatever.
Is that your point? That the problems they were dealing with, to the extent they had notice of those problems and they dealt with those problems in the small notice sense, is irrelevant because it was not notice of a misrepresentation in the agreement.
Correct. And because this agreement contemplates, as do many agreements, that the penalty for agreeing to waive something shouldn't be that you waive it for all time. Because
those are two different points.
Correct, but they're both.
Excuse me, mm-hmm. Two different points. One is that it was related to a representation in the agreement, and arguably there was a waiver by a course of conduct which you would disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
But your primary position seems to be this had nothing to do, these problems had nothing to do with the representations in the master agreement.
My primary position is we have never been given notice of a breach of representation and warranty in the master agreement until they appended Exhibit K to their complaint. That is the first time they ever noticed an alleged breach of a rep and warranty of that master agreement. And the Vice Chancellor said, and he's correct, you cannot square that with Section 1013. That's not the way the process is supposed to work.
How would you characterize what prompted Morgan Stanley to deal with these 47 problem loans?
Well, I'm not allowed to go into that because it's not in the record, but I can see.
I don't want you to go outside the record.
Okay. There's nothing in the record to support their theory that this was an acknowledgement. There's nothing in the record to support that any more than there's anything in the record to support my position, which is parties compromise particular disputes all the time, especially when they know that by doing that, they're not necessarily, and in fact in this case, clearly are not waiving their ability to stand on their rights going forward. And if that's not, if those clauses are not going to be upheld, then it's really going to change the way parties deal with one another, because they're going to be, have to constantly be concerned that a court is going to come in and say, oh, well, you did it here, so you know what? Forget it. You've waived it for all time. That's not what Morgan Stanley understood it was doing. That's not what this agreement lets it do. Now, I do want to make a couple of points further, because...
Well, before you do,
okay,
why is it not a plausible inference from the complaint that the manner in which your client handled the 47, the famous 47, was operated either as a waiver of the strict conditions of notice that were upheld by the vice chancellor later, or merely represented the understanding of both parties as to what the notice requirement actually consisted of?
I think it's not plausible, because it runs afoul of the condition that says, you know, the specific contract condition, Section 14, that says, you know, even if you waive, you're not waiving for all time. And if you're going to allow an inference from that, then essentially you're compromising that clause.
Okay, that may be an answer as to waiver. What about the alternative explanation that what happened in the case of the 47 represented the party's understanding of the type of, and degree of notice that would be required, even under the contract as written?
If they were bringing a suit on the 47 claiming we failed to pay them as we promised to do it, I would say it's perfectly relevant. I would say it has absolutely no relevance at all to this. Those are other loans. They're not suing on those loans. They're suing on different loans, and that would be our position.
Well, by that reasoning, I get the way the first loan number one was handled, would be irrelevant. Loan number two, number three, all the way to 47, and yet the course of conduct was the same.
It was. I just want to make a couple of points about their arguments on discovery and the like. They referenced four New York cases, and they talk about them in their brief. Just wanted to be clear, they cited none of these cases to the Chancery Court. Not one.
We're going to have to leave it at that, because you're out of time.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for your attention.
May it please the Court, I'll respond to some of the points that Mr. Smith made in his argument. First, Mr. Smith spent a lot of time talking about issues that, frankly, are not before the court. As Justice Berger pointed out, the primary issue before this court is notice. We have those four New York cases which have not been distinguished other than on the actual notice ground, which I addressed
Is it true that the cases you're citing to us were not cited to the Vice Chancellor?
Yes, Your Honor. Those cases were not cited to the Vice Chancellor, but the cases that Mr. Smith relied upon, both in the briefs and just now, Argo and Oppenheimer, do deserve a read. Oppenheimer, which I think was the primary case Morgan Stanley's relying upon, had dispositively conditioned precedent-like language in the clause at issue, if and unless and until. Now, Morgan Stanley knew that it could put that language in the contract clause, but it did not. Argo, which I think was the other case cited, is an insurance case, again, with a completely different clause. And notably in Oppenheimer, the Court of Appeals restated that in New York, in the event of any doubt, you interpret as a promise as opposed to a condition precedent. Morgan Stanley has said that there's nothing about cure in the, which I thought was a strange assertion, but nothing about cure in our complaint. We pled that the 47 payments were not just payments for fun, but we specifically said they were cure payments. That's in paragraph 71 of the complaint. And therefore, on a motion to dismiss, that interpretation of the payments, which frankly I think is the only reasonable interpretation in any event, must be credited. We heard some discussion of the other representations in the case. As I think Justice Berger and Justice Jacobs pointed out, Those points were raised by Morgan Stanley below as supporting dismissal with prejudice, and therefore they're clearly required a cross appeal. Morgan Stanley decided not to cross appeal, and therefore it's our submission that those points are not before the court. And finally, with respect to Mr. Smith's point about the contract and courts not being in the business of coming in later and revising the contract, that principle is absolutely applicable on this appeal, because the section that is before the court is a section which speaks plainly and we do not think should be expanded or rewritten, and we think that's precisely what Morgan Stanley did and precisely what the Chancery Court did as a result of Morgan Stanley's urging. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.